Alrighty. Okay. Oh. All right. Well, there have been some, things on my mind, Gary, and I don't know. I just, how do I put this? I've heard a lot of phrases over the years with, the revolution's happening next week or something to that effect. But like one of these phrases I keep hearing over and over again is really about the line in the sand. I remember even Mike. There was a video up on YouTube with Michael Batnorik saying about this has got to be your line in the sand. You've got to stand and defend it, or something to that degree. And I've heard all sorts of other people mentioning this. So I don't know. I mean, do you think the line in the sand's been overused or what?
Well, there are a couple of phrases. When they come to get my guns, I'm going to give them one bullet at a time. And we've drawn a line in the sand. When they step over that line, it's time to do something. And, Waco was, I guess, the first time I really heard line in the sand. I don't know how many times. I was down there for 49 days, I think, and 48 days. And I don't know how many people I talked to on the phone, but everybody's talking about Waco. This is the line in the sand. If they do anything to those people inside there, this is after the first couple of days, the people in there, that's the line in the sand. And if they cross that and do something to those people, that's it. We're going for it. And quite frankly, when I left Waco, I was ready for the second revolution to start because of all this. Let's call it rhetoric. Let's call it what it is. Now, some people have gotten creative and talk about a rope of sand, and I think they're both as demonstrative of what they're talking about. I mean, whether it's a rope in the sand or a line in the sand, the thing is, you can move that sucker and move it again and move it again and move it again and move it again, and it's. Next week, next week, next week.
Yeah, and funny you should say next week. I mean, I've been listening to the intelligence report recently just because I like to pay attention to a couple other people in the alternative media and kind of see what they're kind of jawing on about. And one of the other guys is mentioning mainly about how he's basically giving the impression that because of the supposed additional gun control measures following Sandy Hook that the revolution is happening next week because it's going to be a universal gun ban. And I could have sworn I heard something like that before, like back in, I think it was during the Tea Partier era back in 2009 when Obama first got in. And it's like, oh, he's a commie, socialist, fascist, and he's going to run the country in the ground and the debt and some other five or six other things. We got to have a revolution now. And it's been like, what? He's now just got into his second term.
Well, this current gun ban craze came as a result of Newton in Newtown, I'm sorry, Connecticut. And it's interesting, it's in light of how many, what was it, 28 children died there or something like
Oh,
that.
it's a really low number compared with, drone strikes and all sorts of other crap the government's done, yeah.
Let me read you a list. I just
Oh
happen to have it here in front of me.
no, demo side finals.
Melissa Morrison, age 6. Lisa Martin, age 13. Sheila Martin, age 15. Mina Schneider, age 2. Serenity Jones, age 4. Startled Summers, age 1. Bobby Koresh, age 2. Star Howell, age 6. Cyrus Howell, age 8. Abigail Martinez, age 11. Audrey Martinez, age 13. Crystal Martinez, age 3. Isaiah Martinez, age 4, Joseph Martinez, age 8, Chica Jones, age 2, Little One Jones, age 2, Dalen Gent, age 3, Pages Gent, age 1, Rachel Sylvia, age 12, Hollywood Sylvia, age 2, Chanel Andrade, age 1, unborn child, unborn fetus.
Wait, they count. Wait, the fetus is now a human being now? Wait, did I miss something?
They were listed as those killed in Waco. They would have been born. It wasn't abortion. Well, it was abortion in a way. They would have died in Waco. Those were the children that died in Waco. Now, back then, there was a song that Carl Klanger wrote called 17 Little Children. You may have heard it.
Yeah, I have.
At the time, he thought it was 17. But Those are the children that died in Waco as a consequence of the government's efforts to collect a tax on full automatic weapons, if they did in fact exist. So here, this many years later, what are we, 19 years, 20 years later, almost 20 years later.
Yeah, something like
we've
that.
We've got 28 children die, and people are talking about line in the sand again. Well, it's moved 20 years. That's a pretty flexible line. You remember the article I wrote recently on the blog, the other not-so-thin line.
Yeah, excellent bit. Yeah, I love that thing, yeah.
And what I talk about there is a line that goes from left to right, no political affiliation aligned with this. I'm just going left to right because we read from left to right, and left side is where people enter the patriot community, and the right side is where the people have really gotten to where there really is a line in the sand that they're ready to go. Now, I got involved in the patriot movement to some degree back in the 80s, and it was Internal Revenue Service. That was it until Waco. Actually, in late 92, I started contemplating, and on February 5th, published the first edition of Outpost of Freedom newspaper, and I was going beyond just IRS then. I was getting frustrated as I met people and learned other things. So somewhere around 1992, you could say, or maybe 83, I entered the left side of that line. Now, and I had moved along quite a ways. I'd been moving for, 10 years when Waco came up. But when Waco came up, there was a big, if you look at the thickness of the line indicating the number of people in the line, a big bubble came in with Waco, but that bubble was insignificant compared to the one that came up, about 5 years ago when the economy started to fall apart and the Tea Party movement came into being. But all these people are entering on the left side, and then some move faster and some move slower. So that Waco bubble has drawn out. Some people have fallen out or fallen back, and others have moved ahead. It's gotten thinner. But that big bubble from 5 years ago is still fairly large, but it seems to be stretching out the right a little bit. But now, if you take any person on that line, some might have a line in the sand that's over towards the left, and others might have it not until you get all the way over to the right. Some of us grow too old to really do anything about the line in the sand by the time we get to that point. But how can you define a point that you're really going to do something? Now, another thing that you hear is when they come to get my guns, and I alluded to that a few minutes ago, they'll get it a bullet at a time. But that's a last stand. That's not a line in the sand. That's self-defense. That's your right. But more than likely, it's going to be the last right that you ever defend for yourself, because when they come to get your guns, if you fight back, more than likely they're going to outgun the heck out of you, and it will be your last fight. So it's hard to say what the line of the sand can really be. It's a false hope, or perhaps a...
It sounds like a psychological trick to me, if anything. Like, delaying it until later, like, oh, yeah, well, at some random point in the future when some very vague condition has been achieved or happening, then we're going to act. But for right now, let's not stir the pot too much. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me.
Let's call it an expression of bravado. I think that's probably, I was trying to think of a phrase, and an expression of bravado. It doesn't mean that the bravado is there. It's an expression of bravado. There's conditioning is an interesting aspect. The military has gone to Doom type games. They're a lot more sophisticated than Doom, but you shoot somebody and blood flies and people fall down and they're realistic looking. They're using that now to condition the soldiers to be more killers than they were in previous wars. In fact, previous wars, there was a problem getting some people to shoot at other people. They'd shoot over their heads or down at the ground. They just had a revulsion to that. But in Iraq, I remember, I've got the footage on the webpage where the injured Iraqi, I don't know, for want of another term, I'll call him a freedom fighter, not to start a debate, but he was the enemy, and he was on the ground, and he was down below where this guy was, and this guy keeps shooting at him and missing, and finally he hits him and the body slumps over dead. Mm-hmm. And the guy afterwards, they interviewed him, and he's gleeful. Did you see that? I killed that guy, or something like that.
Right.
That attitude didn't exist in Vietnam, at least in the people that I met that killed somebody.
Well, how do you mean?
He was gleeful because he'd killed this guy.
Oh.
And, you know, it used to be the military saw the benefit of taking prisoners for intelligence information. What information was lost because he decided to kill this guy who was so injured that he couldn't even crawl away, and it was just a matter of time before they could recover him as a prisoner and get intelligence from him. So there's been a shift in the attitude, and that's a result of conditioning. Now let's look at another form of conditioning. Had so many lines in the sand now that, hey, they're just old hat. Now, next time the government does something wrong, I'm going to draw another line in the sand. And so are we conditioning ourselves for defeat by saying that the line in the sand that, you know, we've all heard about it from, who was it, Colonel Travis at Alamo?
It's funny you should mention that, because that was during the Texas Revolution in 1835 and 1836, and especially at the Alamo, where he told the men, look, I'm not going to force any of you to be here. But he took this sword and literally drew the line in the sand and said, look, if you want to stay here and make a last stand, and that pretty much what ended up happening because everybody pretty much got killed, then walk across that line. And I think most, if not all of them did. It was a lot of them anyway. And I think that's where it really came from. So it's not, you know, strictly an American idea. It's really more of a Texan idea, technically.
Well, yeah. I would say that the concept goes back further than that.
Okay, fair enough.
History, and I know Texans think they're the biggest people in the world, but for the sake of the discussion, we'll leave it at the Alamo, because okay. I think that is where the common familiarity came with it. It was, you know, very pronounced in Disney's Davy Crockett, and I've read it in various books about the Alamo, so we know that it occurred there. That's definitely been recorded in history. But that was a line in the sand. And when you crossed that line, your life was given up to the cause. And if you were lucky, you would survive. But if you weren't lucky, you wouldn't survive. It was an absolute and total commitment. And the way it's flung about, I don't want to say used, the way it's flung about today, it's a conditioning, an excuse not to
act.
And, you know, let's look at another instance. That we've got these militia all over the country saying, we're going to back the other militias. If they're attacked, we're going to go after them. If the police try and arrest them, we're going to
attack them.
And there was an incident a couple years ago, and I thought it was rather intriguing. It was called the Hootery Militia. And
oh, yeah, those guys up in Michigan. Yeah, I've heard of them. Yeah, they got acquitted 2 years or a while
well,
back.
Well, wait, don't get there yet.
Oh, whoops.
The Hootery Militia got attacked and got arrested. A bunch of them got arrested, and the government comes out and says, these guys were going to kill cops, and we're going to take them to trial. It was about a year later. Now, during that first couple of weeks, first couple of months, even that first year until almost the end, and I'm not quite sure how it changed almost at the end, but I only recall one article that was supportive of the Hootery Militia. That was done by somebody that wasn't associated.
That's a good point, Gary. Yeah, because I remember at the time when it was still very much, in the government's, den. I remember folks in the Patriot community treating the Hutari as if they were pariah. I remember all of that. Actually, funny you should bring that up.
Right, and the only article I can think of was one called "Thought Crimes," and
yeah,
I think it's still on my blog, but these are people way over on the left side of the line. That's all I can figure out. But the idea is here: what did they look for? The line in the sand came. Militia was being arrested. They jumped at what the government and CBS and CNN told them. These guys were going to kill cops as a justification to move the line down the road again.
Yeah.
So that line got moved. We'll defend any militia in this country if they're attacked. Except the Hootery, because they were going to kill cops, and that's bad. Well, I don't know if that's bad or not.
Well, supposedly. But the point is, it's kind of immaterial either way. The point is, is that, yeah, I remember them being treated like pariah, and I'm only aware of really one other individual.
No,
I think...
let me finish something on that.
Sure, sure.
About a week before the acquittal, an article came out in the Patriot community, basically kind of in defense of the Hootery militia, about a week, maybe 2 weeks before the acquittal. So after a year, somebody finally came back, perhaps knowing, learning from somebody that the acquittal was going to come, and began defending Hootery militia. Well, it's safe now because I can defend them and show that I really meant it back then, but I was lied to by the government. Mm-hmm. And so look at the hypocrisy in the line in the sand.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, actually, funny you should mention the Hatari. I remember, I think you and I mentioned about this, I think I talked with you about this once before probably, when Larkin Rose came out with that article of his that was published on Cop Block about when should you shoot a cop. And I was even kind of, you see, I thought even folks within the Patriot community were going to be more receptive to it, besides just every other political dissident, you know, in these United States. And even a lot of those folks were kind of taken aback, you know, it's the sacredness of the badge. And I guess probably somebody misinterpreted as, you know, something against oath keepers or people like that. But it was like, no, it's like just seriously, just in a self-defense context, when should you shoot a cop? I mean, Larkin Rose even did a vlog that was up on YouTube where he was explaining his article and like, look, here's, you know, what I meant, you know. You know, yes, the title was intended to provoke debate and help people think, but he's kind of he was kind of taken aback by the backlash of it, especially from where it came from. But I think in a lot of ways, he was kind of suggesting one way of actually acting on a line in the sand. It is a very good question. When should you shoot a cop? So,
well, back in 1999, I wrote it was an interview with John, and it was called Popping Cops. And now, Oath Keepers wasn't in existence back in 99. So when I wrote this, I didn't get as much flack as Larkin got, but basically it's talking about the same thing. Who is the first line of defense of the government? It's the cop. Now, Oath Keepers wants to bring them over, but Oath Keepers wanted me off of their Facebook page because I said, they're still arresting people without a warrant, and they're still shooting people or searching their cars without lawful authority to do so.
Yeah, that's actually
I didn't get near as much flack, but I got some flack from people that were associated with law enforcement over that article in 99.
Oh, that's actually perfect you mentioned that because, you know, Oath Keepers, they got a lot of, when they were just starting to grow, they got some flack from the corporate horror mainstream media about the tent when they published, when Stuart Rhodes, the founder, published the 10 orders we will not follow or we refuse to obey or something to that effect. And in a way, those 10 orders are, I guess you could say, a line in the sand, but it's funny you should mention that because now that I think about it, I think it was like one or two of those orders they refused to obey did involve basically violations of what we would understand to be the Fourth Amendment, which is about unreasonable search and seizure. So it's funny you should mention that. Oh, dear Lord.
Yeah, and the irony of the whole thing is in 1900, the case of John Bad Elk versus the United States, where the Supreme Court determined that if a law enforcement officer is making a lawful arrest, and he doesn't have a warrant, proper warrant in his hands, you have every right to let the officer. And as they said in the decision, it would be a misdemeanor, no crime at all. John Bad Elk shot John Killsback. John Killsback had a rifle, but he hadn't raised the rifle. But John Bad Elk picked his up and shot and killed him. The other deputy, I guess, left. They don't really say what the other deputy did, but he left. And then when I was in Waco, I looked at the Waco team that we had down there, one of the guys did some research on what the law was in Texas, and both for arrest warrants and search warrants, you have a right to defense if the person serving the warrant uses more force than is necessary to serve the warrant. You have every right to use force back to the point of killing him. And I think, you know, we talked about this once before, and you even looked up those two statutes.
Yeah, actually, I don't remember the specific number right offhand, but yeah, basically what it more or less says is that in Texas anyway, police brutality is illegal. And yeah, you can basically, you know, you can pretty much kill a cop here in Texas, and it's and that's according to the legal code here. And last time I checked, it wasn't like, you know, repealed or rescinded or anything like that. And so that's even according to the Texas state government, which, you know, I know that a lot of people think Texas is like this bastion of freedom. I mean, I was recently a guest on someone else's internet radio live stream podcast, Doohickey. And one of the impromptu, I guess, co-hosts was a guy from New Zealand. And he actually took some time and explained and said, hey, we thought Texas is this bastion of freedom and is the core Americana. And obviously due to time constraints, I couldn't really get into too much detail. But what I wanted to say was that, you know, there are some problems here too, even with, you know, gun control stuff, even here in Texas, as well as a bunch of other things. So I find it funny that, in a good way, obviously, that one of the things that even to the Texas state government will allow is that let's put it this way, there is an accountability for cops in a very real and physical sense.
Well, I looked up a few months back. It was Texas Penal Code Section 9.3.1, paragraph C. And that was the one about arrests, which the reason we looked it up is under Texas law, David Crash was justified, the people in Mount Carmel Center were justified in shooting back at the police who came in and shot their dogs and started shooting up the building. They had every right under Texas law. Now, what's interesting about the law, I don't know what date that was implemented. I would imagine it was a long time ago, back shortly after the birth of Texas, because it was a way of protecting your liberty and your property.
Damn straight.
So if that's what liberty is, and we've got states that have enacted laws that give you the lawful means of protecting that property, and then when we get a federal government out of the jurisdiction trying to take your property or your liberty away, what's happened to this country? Now, if you want to understand where the line should be, is you need to understand what the law should be and what it is still in Texas, and say that the line in the sand, if somebody comes to arrest me or to seize my property or search my property without a lawful warrant, I have every right to take his life.
Just like you would any other criminal or mugger or robber or what have you, yeah.
Right. And, I think Bastia Ed talked about if the government sneaking in the middle of night, or is the government any different than a burglar sneaking in the middle of the night to steal your property? They're plundering.
Yeah.
You know, if you want a line in the sand, you have to understand where that line should be. Actually, it should be a line in concrete. It should be a line in the Constitution. It should be a line in the Texas Constitution in this case. It should be a line in the Texas statutes. If they cross that line, they are criminal in their actions. And that's why that statute was written, and that's why John Bell got off of murdering a law enforcement officer. Because John Bell stood for that line in the concrete or the Constitution, and the Davidians didn't get off because we've acquiesced to the federal government's saying the law is what we want it to be, not what the Constitution or the statutes or anything else says. So the line in the sand has been breached so many times. It's unbelievable. And so it is, but, you know, it's the line in the sand is drawn, it rains right away.
Yeah.
The line disappears. It's gone. Waiting for somebody to draw it again further down the road.
Yeah, and it's interesting that how you describe that too. Again, invoking Michael Badnarik, even when he described it, he even said, like, look, I mean, it's not really a line in the sand if you initially draw it at one point and then it's crossed or violated, and then you back up, and then instead of what you're supposed to do is stand your ground and resist, if you instead, once the transgression, the trespass happens, you then back up and then draw another line, That's just ineffectual. That's emptiness. That's nothing. That's error. There's no resolve behind that. And in the long run, when that happens, if you keep backing up every time there's a trespass, you're literally falling back each time as if it was a military engagement, because in some ways it very much is. You're backing up constantly until you back yourself up into a wall and there's no one else to run, and then you lose, and you know, you lose your life, your property, your liberty, and ultimately your life. I mean, yeah.
Then you're standing alone. Now, it does two things. The one effect is it conditions us to keep backing up another step and another step until we're against that wall. But the other one, but to keep making steps forward. Yeah. Every time they get away with it, they're encouraged, and the law enforcement officers believe that they have the right to do this stuff. Look at Werner in Tucson. You know, they broke his door down. They had the battering ram there. They broke the door down. They had no right to do that. The whole kid, no-knock warrants were almost impossible to get. You had to know there were gangsters, Tommy guns inside before you could get a no-knock warrant. You had to go up and knock on the door. And there weren't that many casualties as a consequence of that, and they knew if there was a threat within, but they've created the threat themselves because of their practices. And as they get away with these, the concept of John Badalk is gone completely. The Supreme Court decision that says you have a right to protect your liberty. Liberty is denied if you're arrested unlawfully.
Yeah.
You're detained.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court upheld that in 1900, 113 years ago. They upheld that right as being fundamental under the concept of government that we have in this country. Where is that gone? Because every time the police get away with it, they're more empowered. We have empowered them by failing to resist.
Yeah, and actually it's interesting too, because I think there's also, I don't know if it necessarily qualifies, but there might be a certain level of verbicide when it comes to the word fight. Because I've seen people basically say, we're going to fight this, or battle. That's the other one. It's usually those two. This is a battle. This is a fight. And a lot of times, even if they mean it in a sense of like an intellectual contest or some sort of legal wrangling or something, I find it interesting. It's like, for example, like with a lot of the anti-war stuff that's been going on over the past decade or so, I've heard people use terms like, we're going to fight, ironically for another reason, but anyway, putting the double irony aside, we're going to fight to try and bring our troops home, which is, you know, a laudable goal, obviously, for various reasons we won't go, you know, I won't go into here. But at the same time, it's like if a certain congressman, like a Cynthia McKinney type or Ron Paul or whomever, if they fail in bringing the troops home, which unfortunately is what's happened, because they're still over there, then what? You just give up and go home and like, well, I tried to fight. You didn't fight anything. You were doing kind of a diplomatic thing where you walk around, talk to people, and try to do legislative rituals and the rest of it. Or, you know, other people, and they say, like, if somebody's getting charged with some sort of victimless crime or something, we're going to fight this in court. I've heard that one too. But technically, It almost seems to me, Gary, like if somebody's using the like terms fight or battle or whatever, that should only be reserved for actual physical combat. Put another way, you know, the more I study the guerrilla warfare, the more respect I have for the guys, even if I disagreed with them for what they had to go through, different people in different places in history. I mean, for example, even just World War II, the French Maquis, who were trying to oust the Germans when they were occupying, well, specifically Paris, but, you know, France in general. And this is interesting. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the Maquis went up to the National Socialists and, you know, asked them nicely, like, hey, you know, if we file a petition or something, would you please, you know, not, you know, be as tyrannical or something? No, I mean, I could have sworn they got rifles and shot government agents. You know, that almost seems more like fighting to me.
I agree. I think there are different ways to fight. You can fight a traffic ticket. Your intention is to prevail. But I think the context that most people put it in when their bravado is being expressed is, I'm going to fight. And they don't mean that because they can't defeat it in court. They can't defeat it on the streets. They can only defeat it if they do fight the way you're talking about. So they misapply the term, in an expression of bravado. You know, I agree with you completely, even though there are different definitions. In that context, it can only mean one thing, because there is no other battlefield to fight it on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a sense of disrespect more than respect. It is a correct definition of the word out of context in the sentence that they express it in.
Or, yeah, or, you know, or a more contemporary example, actually. When the Tea Partiers try to do what I like to call their second round, this was after the bailouts happened in 2009. I think it was like later that year in 2010 or whatever it happened, with the Obamacare thing that eventually got passed later. But during that interim period, and there was a whole bunch of, you know, the corporate whore media was focusing on some degree, but the alternative media was really going nuts about it, kind of like with the current firearms bubble right now. And they were just going nuts about it, and the Tea Partiers were filing petitions and all this stuff. I remember people at that time saying, we're fighting against socialized medicine. I actually remember, that was a slogan somewhere, like on Tea Party Nation or one of the other websites or outlets or whatever. I remember hearing that. Or even later, fast forward about a little over a year and change or so, when Occupy Wall Street got started, I remember some of those guys even. And you usually don't think of those guys as part of the Patriot community, even in a slight way. But even a lot of them were saying, we're fighting Wall Street. We're fighting, corporations or something. I mean, but the point is, I've heard this over and over again, even within the past couple years.
Let's look at it, though. To fight and file a petition is an effort to at least find a playing field that we might be able to fight and find victory on. To fight Wall Street by demonstrating in the streets is out of context. It's an unwinnable. They think breaking windows and keying cars is going to get corporate America to stand down. I don't think so. So it's unbeatable. But back to the petitions. At least that is the playing field, the game, so to speak, is defined by virtue of the fact they're doing petitions. There's an effort, though probably futile, at least it's in context. It fits what they expressed. Where anonymous on Wall Street, that is
way
out of context.
Yeah, and you know, I don't, obviously, I mean, me personally, I just don't think protesting is a method.
Wait, let me qualify that.
Sure.
If these people are intelligent enough to realize that they can't win by walking down the streets and yelling and screaming.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible that their mental capacities are so limited that they honestly think that they can achieve something by this. But I think they're more trying to get on television than anything else.
A little bit of the attention whore thing. Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. And you know, I've had serious discussions with guys who claimed that they were serious, private conversations, and quite frankly, I've had to tell them, and you know, I'll probably write an article about this some point and put it up on the blog, because it's something that's been bugging me for quite a while. Is I honestly, just objectively speaking, I don't see how protesting works and by protesting I mean street protests or street demonstrations is what I mean. I don't see that as that working to help anyone's of any political ideology, helping them secure their liberties or otherwise achieve whatever other goals they may have. I mean, quite frankly, just to boil it down real quickly, there's really only three outcomes I can see. I mean, either, you know, one, you're trying to basically be like a you know, media whore and grab attention, and then that's supposedly spreading awareness, and then spreading awareness supposedly is going to mystically solve the problem that you're protesting about in the first place, which makes no sense, but that's the explanation that was a different guy actually kind of explained it pretty much that way to me pretty much right off the bat. Second is where a protester does something that technically would be considered civil disobedience. He gets arrested, and then, long story short, basically, he's relying on jury nullification to get him to basically not have him thrown in prison and hopefully establish a judicial case precedent that hopefully will mystically solve some other type of problem. And then, of course, the third goal of protesting, I guess, would be it serves as a opportunity for like-minded individuals or activists or whatever term you want to use, dissidents basically, to get together and have a morale-raising rah-rah-rah fest. But, you know, even when you consider those three, I can think of several other mechanisms or techniques to accomplish or perform any one of those functions with, you know, sans the cost of police brutality and also, and, you know, stuff like that, as well as increasing the effectiveness. So I don't see... But the reason I'm bringing it up, though, Gary, is that I've literally heard people, two things. One, I've heard people say that I'm bad and wrong because I've never gone to a protest, and I have no intention of going to a protest of any kind about anything whatsoever. And two, I've literally heard protesters, guys I've talked with who really are protesters, gone to stuff like that, you know, and all that, basically saying that, well, we're fighting. You know, we're fighting, we're protesting, we're fighting, we're trying to do something against the establishment or something. And I've literally told them, look, I don't see how you acting as a sign-waving coward is somehow moving the case for liberty forward. I just don't.
Well, the last time demonstrations worked was in the late 60s, and it was years, and it was virtually millions of people. And the interesting thing, it was a cause that could develop sympathy and expand and grow. It wasn't as ambiguous as the Tea Party goals. You know, the Tea Party goals were to get representation in Washington. We saw how that worked first round. 60% of them turned against the Tea Party right after they got elected and voted for the debt ceiling increase and the extension of the NDAA, I think it was.
Yeah, and OWS has been a complete failure. It hasn't stopped Wall Street at all, yeah.
Right, but back then, the anti-war movement was, you know, if they'd gotten the war over with, but, you know, I was there, and they weren't fighting to win the war. They were fighting to hold outposts. They'd have search and destroy missions, and then they'd recover back to base, and the Viet Cong would come back in. And there was a futility to Vietnam that over those many years kept growing as the body counts came back, and 58,000, over 58,000 bodies, American bodies, and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese bodies. So that was one that could work, but it took years. You know, the demonstrations started probably 64, 65, and we got out of the war finally in 72. So it took 7 years with a focus on a single objective, and one that could draw emotional support every time a neighborhood boy died in action there. But now you've got this very diverse, well, divide and conquer.
Right.
Going in a dozen directions, and they're splitting their forces. And so the possibility of any success, unless they focus, like the Under One Banner petition, if they focus on something that is tangible, can be readily identified, if they all pursue that goal, we could probably achieve success. But there's no effort. In fact, division. I'm still trying to figure out. CNN gave us, I think, 17 stories on Newtown on the first day.
Oh, dear God.
I was counting the variations of the story.
Yeah.
And now we've got stuff out that actors did the whole thing. None of the children died, or all the children died. Somebody the other day said, no open caskets. I don't know. I haven't seen a televised funeral, so I can't really say if the caskets were open or not. But I would imagine if the kid got shot in the head with high caliber bullet, they would not have an open coffin. But who's been in to see if the coffins are open or not?
Right.
So we're getting CNN has 17 directions. We've probably got only five or six diverse directions the Patriot community over a single issue.
Yeah, and I've heard it from some of the other aspects of the alternative media that who are usually dissidents, not necessarily part of the Patriot community. And I haven't really studied the issue, and it's not, and I don't think it's really important in other regards. But what I have noticed is that there's been some explanations where they think it's a false flag op, and then they say, look, like the one piece of footage on YouTube where the guy, one of the parents or whatever, is like giggling right before he, quote unquote, gets into character because he starts heaving and then he gets all sad or something. And there's been, but I've seen these over and over again. There was another one with a woman, but I gotta say, Gary, it might be possible, but then again, it kind of also seems like conjecture. Two, it could be a lot of things. Who knows why he was heaving and sighing, or who knows why he was giggling beforehand, or any of these other bits of supposed evidence that suggests it's a false flag op, or there was the other one too, Gary, where somebody thought that some of the children that have been around, President Obama, or I like to call him El Presidente, was
I like to
so.
call him the bastard president, lowercase.
How about the tyrant in chief? But okay, the point is that
Well, you're talking about that blonde girl with the red and black dress. Is
yeah,
that?
I've heard that one too, and that was
You
maybe through
know,
alternative media
even
circuits
when I
saying
was a
that.
kid, all the little blonde girls with straight blonde hair looked the same. Now,
And
you put a red and black dress on, if you look at the dress closely, they're not a match. They're similar, but don't make one dress and sell it and then make a different style dress. Even if the dresses were identical, that would mean it's the same girl. But I zoomed in on those pictures, and when I did zoom in, I'm doing better than when I was a kid because they did look different. Their hair was the same, down to their shoulders, nearly straight with the curl on the bottom. That was what I saw in hundreds of, or if not thousands of blonde girls when I was a kid. And then we've got the actor, the school teacher, and the other lady looks like her. I can't think of what her background is, except the other woman looked like she was maybe 5 to 10 years older than the school teacher. But,
oh, that's
well,
right.
they still, their hair was the same.
Oh, hold on. Wait. I might be confusing the different women, but are you referring to the brunette woman who supposedly was sitting next to James Holmes at his trial, or am I thinking of a different woman? Because there was also
That's
that claim
the
too.
same one. That's the
Okay.
same. Yeah, that's the one. And it was a school teacher that apparently hid some kids. I think it was the one who hid the kids in the closet and saved their lives. But she died. And then there was the one with Holmes, and then there are some other pictures of her. But she looks older to me. Maybe
Well,
my
one
age,
guy.
but.
I remember one guy on YouTube, and he basically put the footage right next to each other, and he was narrating over it. And even he said that he thinks they're two different people, especially when he flipped apparently he can manipulate the footage, but he actually showed in his video, he actually flipped it around and said, "Look, especially when the brunette in the Holmes clip, when she turns, she looks very extremely different from the woman in the side footage because he put them side by side." Is there. So I don't know, Gary. It seems like almost
Well,
wanting to see the gremlin
Slinky,
in the corner.
you've heard this before. It's called the power of suggestion.
Yeah.
Watch the flame-throwing tank at Waco. The idea is presented, and you've got this image in your head. And so you look at that and say, hey, looks like that.
God, it
If
is that, isn't
the
it?
statement wasn't, this is the same person, would these people. People look awfully alike, but they're not the same person. Then you would look and say, oh, he's right. They're not the same person. That's the power of a suggestion. And even though it's not on YouTube, that's why I wrote because YouTube said so. That power of suggestion, especially if there's not a whole lot of information to think about,
Yeah.
can be pretty successful means of advertising.
Oh, and
Wheaties,
that.
the breakfast champions.
Yeah, actually, that reminds me of another one. Like another one that people keep mentioning, usually alternative media circles, is that the medical examiner, when he giggled or something, or when he refused to ask questions in a complete and truthful manner, that supposedly that means he's in on it somehow. But again, it just seems like speculation and conjecture. And it's worse.
Well, let's look at a couple of alternatives. He's a piss poor public speaker, and that's why he's locked in the mortuary.
Right.
He's so emotionally distraught by what he's seen that he just can't overcome that emotional distress. So those possibilities? No, let's not consider them because they're not suggested in the title. And let's go to the father that was supposed to be laughing.
Right.
Before he went on and started crying on television or something. I know people that have lost loved ones. They don't give up life. Women are more inclined to be remorse, let me put it this way, in mourning, which used to be a social standard. You had to be in mourning for a certain period of time after something happened. But life goes on, and I'm not sure that I would laugh, but if somebody said something funny, it might be a little relief, and I might laugh if somebody said something trying to cheer me up before I go on camera. by getting me out of that remorse or that sense of loss or the emotional distress. Somebody said something humorous, and I laughed, and that brightened me up a little bit, so I did better when I went on the stage. I can't find fault with that. But to people who have not been through that, who are they to judge how somebody should act under the circumstances?
So
do you
if
think
I'm
he was
right.
gleeful that his daughter died, or do you think that perhaps some other cause that was not presented by the projection, predictive programming perhaps?
Maybe.
Suggestive predictive programming was thrown out to keep you from thinking that there might be something else behind this.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you right, I think what you're trying to say is that since there are other possibilities or alternatives that have not been proven to be incorrect, it is premature and overly judgmental for some of the folks in the alternative media to make the assertion that this is all some evil kind of black ops cover up, false flag op, evil government thing, right?
Right.
Okay.
Suggestive predictive programming. Let's call it what it probably is. You know, one of my signatures, I'm going to read two lines from one of my signatures. The conventional view serves to protect us from the painful job of thinking. Now, the conventional view in this case is the projected view. And then the other one, it is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. And I think that's what's happening, because have people considered what the possibilities are for the man crying? Have they looked closely enough at the pictures to really look and see if they are the same person or if there are enough differences? You know, I remember back in Waco days, Linda Thompson put a picture out of a guy that looked like, I guess it was later than that. It was after 95. She put out a picture of a BATF guy who had different appearance. And she said, that looks like Tim McVeigh. No, it didn't look like Tim McVeigh, but a lot of people bought it. There was another footage that she put out. This was motion picture footage after the bombing at Waco. And she said, that guy looks like Gary Hunt. That's Gary Hunt. He's walking away with this short Indian looking guy. Well, Glenn Wilburn was one of the people that asked me to come to Oklahoma City, and I went down there and went to Glenn's house, and he had did a beautiful job putting videos of me on Montel Williams and this footage of this guy walking away from the still smoking Marat building. The interesting thing about it, which Glenn recognized right away when he met me, is that guy was heavier than me. He had less hair than me, and, you know, walked differently than me. I'm a surveyor. I'm used to walking out in swamps and things like that. So I have a gait that's different than that slouchy gait that guy has. I have to be careful where I put my feet. He just walks on flat surfaces all the time. So there were three things. And then Thompson went. Another time had suggested that she, I don't think I ever saw it, but suggested she had footage of me dressed as a BATF agent. So there's all these speculations and the presentations, and people believe them. The people that knew me, even my wife looked at that footage and said, that guy looks a lot like you. He did. But when she looked closely, she got to see it, you know, and study it, she realized he didn't look that much like me because of his paunch and his lack of hair. But that's the suggestive predictive programming.
Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of the guys who are in the alternative media, and a lot of whom are, you know, reasonably intelligent and well-intentioned and so on and so forth. And I should know, because I actually know some of these, good portion of them personally, actually, and others by reputation. Unfortunately, virtually all of them, to my knowledge anyway, are the products of public schooling. Every once in a while, you'll run into a homeschooler like myself, but and people who were privately schooled, and when I mean that, I mean like they learned the trivium, if you will. But the super majority, even in the alternative media, they don't know how to think, and so they're kind of, a lot of them anyway, at least of the ones I know, are trying to make a good faith effort to do it, but it's still like grinding this painful thing. So when they make baseless speculations and conjectures, I can't help but try and politely point out some things they may be missing or some, dare shall I say, logical fallacies that are there. And their reactions vary, sometimes hostile, sometimes not. But, I mean, you're right.
Well, look at it this way. If I have a conclusion in mind, then I'm going to wrap the facts to fit the conclusion, and I've got to discard the facts that don't match the conclusion I want. That's, again, back to my signature and some of my emails. I try and not jump to a conclusion. I try and, you know, an event happened. For example, the death of Michael. But I kind of threw that aside, and I looked at the autopsy report. I looked at the autopsy photographs. I talked to people that were there that night when he was shot. I went down to the sheriff's department, got access to the evidence room, looked through that, and looked at any of the evidence regarding it that I could. But I didn't come to the conclusion until after I had all this evidence. And then the conclusion, the death of Michael Hill, which is on my webpage, the conclusion I came through to, quite simply, was he was shot by, and nobody had speculated this before, but the evidence of support that he was shot, the two cops that rolled on the scene later, because the one gunshot had to be taken either from a very, very tall person shooting almost straight down, or when Mike Hill was lying on the ground. He could not have been shot in the gunfight that Officer Mace had. But see, nobody had even touched that because they jumped to conclusions. And then there were other factors where the brain matter was down by his knees. How did it get down there? Well, he must have been sitting up somewhere along the line. And that then looking at the gun and the bullet that hit the gun, it appears that they propped him up to make it look like to tie the gun to him. And put it in his hands and then shot him. And when the bullet hit the gun, pieces of brain matter had dripped out of the hole in his head. But when the bullet that hit the 45 splayed out, it threw little pieces of metal into his hand and his left leg. Jeez. Now, how did the splaying bullet get in his left leg if the gun was shot while he was standing up in a gunfight?
It couldn't. So yeah, I see what you mean. The ballistics don't match. Okay.
Right. And so there were two things there in particular. There are other subtle ones that are in the report, but there were two things that occurred there that made all the stories that I had heard before I got there impossible to have occurred the way they were told. And it did tie these second guy coming up, and then second and third cop. May had a guy in the back seat who wouldn't even open his mouth, a young kid that wanted to be cop. But the only thing that fit is these other guys rolled on the scene. Mike was rolling around on the ground in agony, still alive, and they shot him, and it grazed his cheek and went in the top of his shoulder. That's the one that was impossible in the gunfight. Then the damaged gun and the splayed bullet in his leg was the other one. So these guys must have cooperated with May to tie the gun to Mike. Mike probably didn't have a gun in his hand when the gunfight ensued. They had to tie the gun to his hand, put it in his hand, shoot the bullet, hit the gun, and the angle doesn't cut from a gunfight either. Mm-hmm. So all these things, but it was a matter of ignoring what Mike's wife told me. This guy Raymond down there was very helpful, but he had come to his conclusion. Joseph Iacoparo and the people that saw it that night had come to their conclusion, even though they didn't see the whole thing, because as soon as the first shot was fired, they fled. May's story didn't fit. The two cops that came on the scene later didn't fit. But everybody had their conclusion, and they tried to prove their conclusion. And again, I just looked at all the evidence before I came to a conclusion.
Yeah, and you see, that's the thing too, is that, you know, if somebody's actually skilled, even in an amateur capacity, quote unquote, as an investigative journalist, you would be able to, you know, reason all of that out and just you know, look at the evidence and figure that out as much. And unfortunately, a lot of the alternative media instead, now there are some good guys out there, when those are the guys I usually pay attention to, but unfortunately, a lot of what I've been noticing is that I don't really hear that kind of analysis, that really good substantive stuff, like how you just described. In fact, what I've been noticing is a lot of sensationalistic garbage. Again, like I just mentioned, and you did as well, regarding the Sandy Hook thing with, you know, supposed whatever. That's just basic. That I think is just conjecture, because it sounds sexy. It sounds, dare shall I say, glamorous, even in a certain perverted kind of context. And really, I really just think it's the worst aspects of the alternative media, that kind of cheesy tabloidy aspect to it. And it very much is kind of a tabloid aspect when they do it. And, you know, there's been a term that I've picked up from other folks, and, you know, I've kind of run with it, which is, you know, the carnival of distractions. And I'm sorry, I look at Sandy Hook, and the only thing I can think of is it's carnival of distraction material. I have not heard a description of the events of Sandy Hook to the degree and the details necessary, like how you just did with Michael Hill, where you basically kind of slice and dice it, you know, rationally and whatnot. And also considering, too, what complicates the Sandy Hook thing, which kind of, you know, really kind of gets back to the line in the sand concept, is the proposed gun bans at the federal level with, you know, Obama basically saying that, we'll either have Congress maybe do something, or maybe I'll just sign it in an executive order or something. And then, of course, anybody who's, you know, a dissident, or anyone who's got their brain screwed on at least a little bit straight, starts to freak out because they understand a little bit about civilian disarmament and how a lot of times that can lead to democide. And so then they go into a frenzy of firearms buying, but that's not how you're supposed to actually, you know, in a mature way, go about acquiring firearms. You're supposed to do it slowly over time. And then, of course, what that's created is this kind of stampeding herd effect, which is really the current firearms bubble that's going on right now, which kind of reminds me of the bubble that happened last year at about the same time of year, as last December, which broke, and that one broke the records of the one that was the 2009 Obama gun scare. And so the firearms prices are artificially inflated. Last time I checked, ARs have tripled in price. But the only reason for that happening, at least the claimed reason, and the alternative media is really pushing this right now, or perhaps just the carnival aspects of it, because that's what I think anyway, is just the government, they're gonna ban it, supposedly. They're gonna ban it. So buy your stuff now. Buy your 30-round AR mags now before they go ban. You know, it's this very much panicky, fake atmosphere. It almost sounds like a used car salesman almost.
Well, look at CNN the day of the Newtown shooting. They came out with footage of children being led by a teacher with their eyes closed away from the building, and they also showed cops entering the building. And as near as I can tell, CNN presented that, indicating that this is probably live coverage. Now, Intel Hub is the source that I saw. The Intel Hub, I think it is the source I saw this footage on. But they say that the same thing happened at St. Rose Preschool. It was a active shooter training exercise. And they imply in the article on The Intel Hub that it happened the same day. My guess is it happened long before then, because I did a little research and I found out in Henderson, Nevada, in July of 2011, they had active shooter training in schools. So apparently this active shooter training has been going on for a long time. But to show how the press plays into that, you go back 3 or 4 years, and whenever they use file footage you saw on the screen, file footage on the imagery that was put on television, they didn't put file footage on this St. Rose Preschool exercise, but it was obviously an exercise, because when the cops are going in, the cones are marking their entryway. There's traffic cones on the first parking stall in the walkway leading up to the building, and you can look at the aerial preschool and you can see the same nose on the curbing and the same walkway. Everything's exactly the same. The children are coming out, and you can see one of the traffic cones back and back. And there were no traffic cones at, you know, when there's an active shooter in real life, they're not going to go lay out traffic cones. Yeah. Like they did for this training exercise. I guess the cops are dumb. Go between the cones when you go in the school. But we have no idea when the St. Rose was, and they didn't indicate that. They implied that it was the same day, as if that leads us to conspiracy theory. They have the training down at this other preschool a couple miles away, and the event is in reality happening here at Sandy Hook Elementary. Mm. So they, even though they were kind of half right in what they did is try and tie some things together that weren't quite necessarily true. I don't know if anybody looked into it or not, but and they probably don't. You know, here's another example. People are afraid to call the government and ask questions. But the detective that investigated Mike Hill's death, now, he hadn't come to conclusions. He just filed his reports. But I called him. He let me in. I called the Fraserburg Police Department, or went to the Fraserburg Police Department. Now, May was supposed to be on vacation. However, I saw him shut the door down the hall. But the chief came out and said he's on vacation, so I couldn't talk to him. But you can talk to government people. But another instance where I did my homework, it was called the bombing. I called Mr. Brown, I think it's Ron Brown from the U.S. Oklahoma Geological Survey or U.S. Geological Survey, I forgot which, and talked with him. And when I talked with him, I said, you know, everybody's reporting that you said there were two bombings. And he said, I never said there were two bombings. I said there were two events. And I said, well, what's an event? He said, an event's an occurrence on the seismograph. And so we talked about it, and he explained there's a surface and a subsurface image. One goes in the bedrock and one goes on the surface. And the further it is away, the greater the distance between the time interval between these two events occurring. And he explained that the Omniplex, less than a mile from the Mra building, didn't show two events because the proximity, there would be the same time lapse based on the distance. They overlap to a point that you couldn't distinguish the first from the second because it was so close. Mm-hmm. And so in talking with him, he said that everybody he sent the seismograph to, he also sent the Omniplex seismograph to. Nobody published the Omniplex seismograph. Everybody showed the Geological Survey one that showed these two nearly identical events, as he explained, was one bomb.
Yeah. And I think those are the ones that have that made into various documentaries that I've seen. And so, wow, you're saying there were actually more graphs than that then.
Well, if you go to my Oklahoma City bombing page, and I think it's what happened in Oklahoma City number 3, but you'll see both the Omniplex and the Geological Survey seismographs.
Oh, wow.
But yes, I mean, I've got two pieces of evidence here, and if they ask questions, Brown would have explained why there's two events on the – and the interesting thing is there's kind of 9 steps on the event, which is the 9 floors falling down. But he explained to everybody what the events were, but people threw away the Omniplex one. They didn't publish it. I don't know how many pages I've gone through in the last, 18 years, 17 years. And I have never seen the Omniplex seismograph shown on any page but my own. Nobody wants to talk about it. So here we've got two pieces of evidence. One fits the theory. The other one doesn't fit the theory. So they throw the one that doesn't fit the theory away. And now they've got a fact that supports the conclusion that they want, that there were two bombs.
Yeah, and actually, I remember when I was really getting started in the alternative media, I was mainly running off of what I'd seen in various various documentaries. And obviously, yes, that phenomenon is unfortunately subject to because YouTube said so. And I should know because I was an amateur videographer for a while before I closed my YouTube channel down, so I kind of understand both sides of that. But yeah, I mean, I remember watching 9/11 Road to Tyranny and Terror Storm, both are AJ's films. And, you know, he, apparently, I think in one or both of them or something, there's footage of him where he's actually in Oklahoma City and he's like, you know, with the seismograph thing and he's interviewing some random guy on the street or something. And it looked, and to me, and I didn't know any better really at the time, it looked legit to me. And so it looked like, wow, okay, so I guess that's what happened because he said so, right?
One power of suggestion, right?
Hey, to be perfectly honest, I mean, even despite my background and, you know, my education, I mean, I guess, you know, it's possible for anyone to make a mistake, and in this case, I did. I just didn't know any better. It was just a lack of data at that point. But it still showed I was giving a lot of credence to a source that I shouldn't have, or a type of source, too.
There's a lot of people that claim they're investigative reporters in the Patriot community or researchers, one or the other. Investigative reporters basically covering news events, which was what we've been talking about. And there are researchers who look into, say, more historical things.
Right.
And Randy was going to do a radio show once, and he had a proposed guest, Joyce Riley, and she was going to talk about U.S. Corporation, the corporation that everybody talks about, you know, the government's corporation with the channel and all this stuff. But he wanted to find out if she was for real and everything, so he asked me if I would interview her with him, not on the radio, but to see if he wanted to do the show. And so we called and talked to her, and I prepared a little document. You know, I did some research. I got the 1871 Act, and I went to the U.S. There are two elements people used to support that. One is the Congressional Act of 1871 creating the Washington, D.C., and the other one is a U.S. code, a statute that says the United States is defined as a corporation. It lists about five or six things. And so when we were talking to Joyce, she says she was a researcher and she does the research, and I said, do you have a copy? I was going to point out some things to her in the 1871 Act. And I said, do you have a copy of the act? I said, no. I said, you said you're a researcher. You don't have a copy of the act, the source document for what you're talking about. And she kind of hemmed and hawed, well, I've got the parts that I need and all this.
Oh, no.
And then I said, well, have you really researched this? And she said, yes, I have. And I said, well, and you don't have the entire Act of 1871? She said, well, I don't need it. I read what other people do. That's my research. I read what other people write, and then I write it in my own words. Well, needless to say, Randy did not have her on the show.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
But there's a researcher. She claims to be a researcher. Now, how many people in the Patriot community honestly claim to be researchers or investigative reporters?
Yeah, I mean, hey, I mean, I know I do those book reports on my blog, but at least I make it a point that I'm looking at the content of this particular book. I try to do it in a vacuum as much as possible, hey. Although every once in a while I'll draw inferences or compare stuff. But I don't make a claim that I'm a researcher when I'm doing those book reviews. So I see the distinction that you're making with Joyce about Joyce Riley.
Yeah, but see, you're not claiming to be a researcher or an investigative reporter. You're doing a review of book, and it's a subjective review done by Sleepy Salsa, right, of a book written by Joe Smith. Hey, that you admit what it is.
Yeah.
You might be wrong. You disagree with him. You might be right wrong if you agree with him.
Right.
You might be right in either case as well. But that's totally different. That's a rather subjective analysis of something. If you're reporting news or reporting something of historical nature, there should be an obligation to present it well-researched or well-investigated, either one.
You're talking about original material.
Well, in research, yes, original material. In investigation, going out and talking to people that are players in the game.
Yeah. And so
you can talk. A lot of these investigative reporters have read these books by so-and-so. You know, and some of these books even say I'm a lawyer. You know, they say I'm a lawyer. I think three or four books, published books, say that Gary Hunt's a lawyer from Florida. I've never been a lawyer. I was a law student, but then I gave that up for surveying. I'm not a lawyer, never have been, never would be. I wouldn't want to. In fact, I'm glad I changed my direction.
Yeah, so I just...
I changed my pursuit in life.
Right.
I mean, it's rather offensive to call me a lawyer.
Well, there's the Shakespeare line, obviously, about lawyers. But, yeah, I mean, even during my college years... and yes, some colleges will accept homeschoolers, obviously.
Well, let me finish the point on that.
Sure, sure, please.
I have never been hard to find. When I took my daughter's first birthday, I took 2 weeks off, went to Connecticut. We went up to Massachusetts, went Battle Road, and went up to New Hampshire. And we spent a couple weeks together. When I got back to South Bend, this is how easy I am to find. There were 17 messages asking me to go to Oklahoma City, Glenn Wilburn, J.D. Cash, Richard Reyna from Jones's defense team, Bill Jasper, and I forgot the others. Media Bypass Magazine wanted to talk to me about it because of Thompson stuff. And so I was not hard to find. I never have been. You know, when I put out my fax releases back in the 90s, they always had where I was when the fax release went out. In fact, I was just reading one today that I posted on the blog today. If you look at the original, I was in on Peoria Avenue, the street address, the phone number where I was staying in Arizona, Phoenix. And so I was never hard to find. Whenever I put a fax out, I gave a return number where I could be reached. So I've never been hard to find, but these people write these books and they accuse me of being a government agent. Well, you know what happened when we did the John Doe 4 radio show with Randy.
Yeah, I remember that.
All these claims, but then nobody tried to find out if I was really there or not. And I think that after the show was completed, it was pretty well understood that I, unless I had a transporter, I couldn't have been in Oklahoma City and downtown Orlando at the Huey Building at the same time.
Right, right. It's not feasible. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting too.
But they researched this John Doe 4 thing and Bill Cooper said it, so it must be true. And then I found it on 40,000 web pages saying Gary Hunt's John Doe 4. So that's good. I've done my research.
Yeah. It's obviously that was completely untrue as we did on that episode. But yeah, but even during my college years, when I would write, you know, research or term papers for my professors, I mean, everyone in my class, now they may have forgotten since then, of course, but at least I remember that there's a difference between, like, you know, primary sources and secondary sources and tertiary sources, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're trying to do something as original, whatever you're working on is as original as possible, you want to keep as close to primary sources as possible. And especially much more so if you're doing an investigative journalist type thing, you know, you want to be talking to witnesses, you know, people that were there or people who observed something or did something, you know, et cetera, not, not basing it off rumor that someone else said. I mean, that doesn't count as evidence, not even... It doesn't even count as an affidavit or anything like that.
In all fairness, in Oklahoma City, sometimes even primary witnesses don't have everything together. Well, we saw what happened with Brown and other people, but there were at least two recordings of the sound of two explosions short distance apart. Mm-hmm. One was recording a meeting that was going on somewhere, and I forgot what the other one was. So that you've got two instances, and they said there were two explosions. I heard them both. But what could that possibly be? And now here's where you have to come in with, what do they call it, critical thinking. Are there any other possibilities? Well, if I blow a bunch of air into a building with a percussive bomb, an air blast like a NFO or the ammonium nitrate which we found out later it was, all this air goes into this confined space. And then it comes back out. And then we start having thud, 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 the building fall apart. But the two loud sounds are caused by vibration in the air. One is the initial explosion, and the second one is this air that's jammed in at a phenomenal velocity. And then now it has to come back out of the building. And that would create another boom. So I believe the recordings are the explosion and the return of that air coming back out of the building.
Yeah, and it's funny you should mention that, too, because that reminds me of several conversations I've had over the past...
Wait, I said I believe that. But it is a possibility that if I heard two explosions, one of them could have been that other one. I wasn't there, and I can't say for sure. So I'm trying to be objective about it. I believe that the second sound was the air coming back out, because it has to come back out, and it's going to have comparable velocity, nearly comparable velocity to the initial explosion, which is the sound itself.
Gary, how dare you be intellectually honest? I mean, look, I remember, conversations I've had with folks, especially over the past decade, well before I got involved with the alternative media in any capacity. And I remember there were folks just coming out of the woodwork through the alternative media at that time. I remember thinking to myself, wow, I never knew there were so many quote-unquote engineers that knew oh so much, of course, about controlled demolition. They just came out of the woodwork. I was kind of surprised, like, where were they before? And of course, it then turned out later they really aren't engineers. They were just people thinking that they knew anything about physics or chemistry or anything like that, and so they made all sorts of claims about controlled demolition. I mean, I remember stuff like that. It's awful too. Like any of these events, it's like there's no concept of really objective analysis, and quite frankly, it makes a mockery of it really makes the alternative media look bad, because the alternative media, the whole point of it was to get around the corporate whore mainstream media, which is basically controlled by the establishment and pretty much more or less in a lot of respects by the government in a lot of ways. So
and falling into the same trap though. The objective is probably different, because if we look at CNN not saying file footage, there seems to be intending to achieve a false presentation where the Patriot community is trying to create a conclusion that meets their preconceived conception of the event. So
yeah.
There's a slight difference between the two. But yes, it's very deceptive to do that and to make claims that they are. I mean, I'd like to see somebody prove their credentials by showing a history of investigative reporting or research, historical.
Or, something along those lines,
I think you've seen enough of both types of work of mine, the historical, as well as the investigative reporting that is substantiated. Who I talked to, what they determined, or what they told me. Mike Hill's case, pictures of the gun, pictures of the autopsy. I do my homework. Somebody else, all these people that lay this claim, I have yet to see one that can demonstrate that they have properly done an investigation or properly done the research they talk about. Yep. Just read one today that came to me. It was rather interesting. It talks about the Miller decision in 1939 and John Bad Elk, but he did not give cites. He didn't give the U.S. Supreme Court cite for it. He just gave the years.
No.
He's not even giving you enough information to make it easy to track down. If I give John Bad Elk.
You're supposed to cite your sources, though. That's just not playing fair.
Well, it's not. Whether he's read them or not, I don't know. But it's just like with Joyce Riley, do you have the Act of 1871? Well, I've got it on my computer. Anybody want a copy, I'll be glad to send it to them.
Unfortunately, because of the behavior on the alternative media side, I've really, unfortunately, in my life, especially these past couple of years, at least that I've noticed, they've really been pandering with the and there really isn't a better term that I can think of other than that kind of sensationalistic garbage. But wait a minute, I thought the corporate whore, I thought Americans were sick, at least those who were dissidents or otherwise not the mainline public in one shape or form, were disgusted with the corporate whore media for many reasons, but one of those kind of recurring reasons was because of sensationalistic garbage. But now I'm seeing it on the alternative media side, which is, that's not good. And so really, it becomes a carnival of distractions. And then that, obfuscates the good work that the alternative media does. And so, that needs to stop or at least be mitigated or something. But unfortunately,
let's go a little further than obfuscates. Let's look at who it serves.
Yeah. Somebody's private.
Who does it serve?
I don't know, somebody's private agenda or glamorizing.
Well, if it creates division in the community because people listen to this and want to believe it, and somebody listens to that and wants to believe it, and somebody else listens to that and wants to believe it, it's created division. That's the most effective tool the government has, is creating division. So these people, whether knowingly or just out of their whatever motivates them to pursue these false leads and try and give credence to them, they end up serving the government intentionally or unintentionally. They serve the government by creating this division, don't they?
Yeah, they do, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether they're controlled opposition or useful idiots. The result is the same. And I would also say, more in a recent sense with Sandy Hook, I've pretty much kind of heard different versions, and I could study more of it if I want to. I just don't think it's ultimately important, because the result is the same with the Hegelian dialectic. I mean, the establishment is trying to push for gun control, more gun control to some degree, I guess, maybe, but even if they did, and even that's kind of debatable, but even if they did, I don't really see that necessarily as a problem. In fact, I would prefer to see it as a good thing in one sense. Think about it. If the government basically, if it is true what some alternative media people are saying, that, oh, the gun ban's going to go into effect, or a magazine restriction, or whatever version it happens to be, why don't we use that, and let's assume it does happen, why don't we just use that as a recruiting tool, and then we help move them on down the line? So any which way it plays, as long as we have the proper mindset about it, I think we kind of win either way, in a manner of speaking. So I don't personally worry about it, other than that firearms bubble. But even that, I'm not, I just wait until the bubble pops and prices stabilize. So even that's kind of fixable already, because I understand economics. So in the overall aggregate, I don't wonder why some of the truthers or other types of guys in the alternative media are still like obsessing and still talking about Sandy Hook. It's getting a little creepy even for me, Gary.
Well, I mean, you can prove anything you want. All you have to do is pick which CNN news feeds you've got, and which, there's a page that shows that all these people are the same people and that they're actors. And then there's the one that says nobody died. And then there's no close, open coffin, which I guess supports that. But then where those kids go, flying saucers or something? But, we pick and choose. Yes, put it together. And you will serve the enemy more than you will serve the patriot community.
Right, right. And so, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, depending on what the establishment eventually ends up doing, what is that line in the sand, not just, for this particular specific, possible weapons ban, but I mean, like, in an overall sense, I mean, what things should not be tolerated? I mean, which is the point at which, it's time to, have a good old home down and, get physical, so to speak. I mean,
well, what if we came up with a credible news source for the patriot community?
Hell, that would be an improvement.
Well, I think you came up with an idea that was, let me say, in error about a year ago.
Sure, yeah.
And it got modified to bring it into something that I've thought about for a long time, which is establishing a credible source for news and even research information for the patriot community, so that the reliability factor would be based on the source. It wouldn't be the Intel Hub. If I had done the Intel Hub story, I would have called St. Rose Preschool and asked them what day they had, when they had that active shooter drill, to be able to assign something to that picture to prove that CNN falsely and perhaps maliciously presented it on that day to make it appear that something had occurred down the street the same time this event was occurring at Sandy Hook. We're going to sooner or later, the Committee for Digital Correspondence is the name that we developed for it. It's on committee.org now, and there was a true story put out there, 5-part series done by Amelia Foxwell. She did an excellent job on it, interviewing a lady who happened to run into Charles Dyer in a campground in Texas. The information was verified. It's a true story. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the Patriot press. Perhaps it should.
Yeah,
maybe they should see what can be done.
Yeah, and it's funny you should bring that up. I have read that, and I have not really seen much coverage of that, or frankly, a lot, you know, really anything with you know, that particular, you know, saga. And you know, it's, I don't know, I almost feel like certain things are being ignored by the alternative media when they shouldn't. I mean, let's take something really simple like committees of safety, or any one of a handful of things. I mean, I remember, Gary, about 6, 7 years ago or so, I remember, you know, AJ, for example, being really hyped up on a militia, and you need to go start a militia. Okay, well, and then he modified it to, okay, don't call it a militia, but it's still a militia. And now we fast forward to now, and even some of the other, you know, Patriot rock stars I still listen to, who aren't as bad, but it kind of gives me an idea about how they're, well, for lack of a better term, they're spinning things. Even some of them are saying, wow, AJ's really gone off the deep end even more so than he kind of somewhat would already, because now he's saying the militia is bad. And I went and I double checked, and yeah, according to him, the militia is bad now, which is kind of weird, because that's my point though, is that I don't know. I feel that the alternative media is distracting people with a lot of stuff, that at least a good portion of it, they're distracting people with this it's this carnival atmosphere on all this crap that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter today, and even less tomorrow. And instead of actually helping teach and instruct people in what they need to know and the skills they need to know in order to secure their liberties, which I think, and there, don't get me wrong, there have been some attempts to do that with like certain, I don't know, tutorials or whatever, but generally speaking, it's not like the main thrust. In fact, I remember, I know this can be a kind of a touchy subject, but as much as I like the guy, I kind of had my own doubts about Ron Paul, and we all saw how that turned out. I mean, think of it this way, the all those donations, what was it? I mean, this past electoral cycle was like, what, $40 million or something? It was a lot of money. So imagine if instead of $40 million for one single presidential campaign that completely flopped, and by the way, I mean, I remember when Adam Kokesh was actually trying to get a refund, actually, which is funny because Kokesh got his start, in the alternative media because he gave a speech at a Ron Paul rally. But that's I'll say that for another time, obviously. But what I thought was interesting was that
sounds rather hypocritical. I think
in Kokesh's defense, what I'll say is that I think he's maturing, and I'll leave it at that. But
that could be, but it was hypocritical to ask for his money back because education costs money, and if he learned something from it, he should have realized that contribution was tuition, and he had no right to ask for it back.
Touche.
He gave it voluntarily.
Touche. Touche.
Is he collecting money on false pretexts now? For example, he did everything he could to get arrested at, what was it, the Lincoln Memorial?
Jefferson
Memorial.
Yeah.
Did everything he could to get arrested so that he could raise funds for it. But he didn't say that he was doing everything he could to get arrested. So that was a false pretense on his part, which was more divisive than Ron Paul's honestly trying to seek the nomination for president of the United States.
Well,
so
yeah.
If we look at it from Kokesh's side, well, everybody that made contributions based on his getting arrested at the Jefferson Memorial should ask for their money back.
that's an interesting explanation. I haven't quite heard that one. What I will say is that $40 million, imagine what else that could have been applied to. I mean, that could have been training or in-person, you know, field training and equipment for militia. That could have been office equipment and, I don't know, messaging, cryptography type.
It could have, but now think of the education that we got out of that, too, that the fact that the Republican Party will control, they will change the rules in the middle of a convention. They will do whatever they have to exclude anybody that isn't their handpicked nominee for president of the United States. So it was an expensive education, $40 million. It was a lot to learn that. Some of us knew that existed before then. I mean, I've written about politics a few times. And I know that if you haven't kissed the ass of those in power in the party, and most of their names are never known, that you ain't going to go nowhere. You will never get party support. They control the whatever they call that local committee in big cities, and they control the whole thing, and you ain't going to get in. And look at all the footage that came out of the conventions where, one, they voted out the chairman and voted in a new chairman, and the old chairman then called the police to kick out the new chairman and arrest him so that they could go on with the convention under the changed rules that the party had used to exclude the Ron Paul supporters.
Yeah, and you remember when...
I think in Phoenix, they weren't allowing the elected delegates in the convention unless they agreed to support Romney.
Yeah, and obviously there are many problems with the whole Ron Paul effort, but I really want to point to that one about that.
Well, my point, though, sure, is it was more expensive. It was an education in the reality of the two-party system.
Right, right, right. And you can't even – you can't infiltrate the government in order to turn around on itself as it is now and like limit it or whatever, at least not that way.
Look at how many people are realizing that the Democrats and the Republicans ain't all that much different. So that $40 million, but I would say at least 40 million people have begun to question the two-party system that we have instituted and they have cemented their control of in this country.
I would even go to the next step and say that even for people who understand the left-right paradigm and how fakey it is, you still can't have your anti-establishment candidate, which is why Ron Paul was billed as, infiltrate one of the supposed factions, in this case the Republican Party, infiltrate it, seize power, kind of like a quasi-peaceful coup d'etat. It's kind of how it was billed to those of us who kind of had an idea of what was going on. And then he'll mystically, get the troops back and solve everything with a flick of his pen, basically. Any which way you slice it, and obviously that would be a discussion for another time because there's many details with that. But yeah, exactly. You're right. It is a very expensive education.
A necessary one. I mean, how else could that two-party control of the entire process have been made public to the extent that it was? Perhaps an advertising campaign, but that's just words. But here, in reality, it was demonstrated over and over and over again.
Right, right. And actually, you mentioned Kokesh a moment ago about getting arrested. I remember when he did that, that was billed as an act of civil disobedience to basically demonstrate how awful the establishment is. And that kind of reminded me of what pretty much... for the most part, what the Free State Project, the Free Staters, those libertarians, the whole idea of libertarians move to New Hampshire and try and make the place freer somehow. And those guys over the years have been basically trying to grab media attention by getting arrested for doing things like, smoking hemp in a park or something. And so it's almost...
But that's sensationalism for the purpose of raising funds. It's deceptive.
Right, and so in a sense, Kokesh, is obviously not unique. He was just following what is now the mainline libertarian practice of blatantly committing an act of civil disobedience with how you described it. And I gotta say, I understand Thoreau. I even wrote an article going through his infamous essay on the duty of civil disobedience. I really don't see him justifying this twist on it, I guess is the nice way to put it.
Well, that's it. Let's go back to the 60s again, the anti-war demonstrations. I was arrested once at a demonstration, and I didn't like it. I was going to have to say, of course, we didn't have the internet, and there was no way to have a defense fund, which reminds me of Luke Gutkowski as well.
Oh, yeah.
Have defense funds. Hundreds of people get arrested. Each one's on his own. He's got to come up with his own bail money, and then he's got to defend himself or get the hope the charges get dropped. But there were many number of times that we were willing to get arrested, and fortunately it was just the one in Santa Cruz where I got arrested. But the commitment was there. We knew we could get arrested, and we knew that then we were in our own hands. We didn't have salvation in financial contributions that actually become profitable at a certain point. And again, I'm thinking of Luke Rutkowski, where the charges were dropped. I think the common law court had that unanswered indictment. The charges were dropped, and he raised thousands of dollars in that campaign, something like that. I don't recall.
It was the Biaz versus Rutkowski unanswered indictment. Yeah, I remember reading that. And yeah, it's
so these guys now do it as a form of sensationalism, not a form of commitment. So there's a significant difference when your motive. How pure is his motivation in getting arrested? Let me put it that way. Is his objective to raise money and actually profit by the arrest? Or is it a commitment that is going to take from him without recourse to have that expense in both time and economic or financial expense to be a burden on him? You know, is he really following the concept of
civil disobedience
in the proper context, or has it become a tool of selling newspapers?
Yeah. And actually, it's there was a documentary I watched about a month or so ago. Came as a recommendation. I listened to the guy describe what it was about, and I said, okay, fine, I'll take a look at it. And it was actually enlightening in a couple of ways, but not, I don't mean this in a positive sense, and here's why. It was entitled Derek J's Victimless Crime Spree, and it was a documentary that basically followed who apparently is now, he's not really a Patriot rock star, but he's like a wannabe, I guess. He's more in the libertarian circles, not what you would normally think was the Patriot community. But, Derek J, and he was a Free Stater for a while. And basically the film basically documents his arrival as a Free Stater in New Hampshire and shows him kind of getting along and doing all the, libertarian activist stuff. And then it also shows the different actions they went to, like combination of street protests, local radio stuff he's hosted, different civil disobedience things like smoking cannabis in a park, for example. And also a lot of it is because part of the joke in the title about victimless crimes, it's victimless crime spree. So a lot of it is obviously him getting arrested. Now, they didn't mention this in the film. I'm mentioning this more just as kind of his background. But there was always a joke I was aware of ever since FSP started that if one-third of the Free Staters are not in prison at any one time, they're doing something wrong. There were so many of them getting arrested as frequently as they were that approximately one-third of all known Free Staters were constantly in prison, but it was kind of rotating out. In fact, in that film, they actually mentioned, and I'm not going to get the term exactly right, but it's immaterial. They actually called, I think it was the prison, it's like some sort of smaller prison, I think it's in Keene. They called it the Keene Spiritual Retreat. That's what they called one of the local prisons. Because so many of them had gotten in there, yeah. And basically, long story short, you basically go to the end of the film, and Derek J, because there are also some scenes where he's in the courtroom and the judge is being all, I think the judge was being tyrannical, that's my personal opinion. But the point is that at one point, there's a scene toward the end where Derek J is looking at all of these pieces of paper that are basically charges against him where he's been sentenced, or he's about to be sentenced, or something like that. And at one point, he had a choice, and he's narrating, and you hear him. He's basically says that, I had a choice. Basically, I was looking at, what was it? It was like 20 years in prison for, it was like consecutive sentences. It was really a lot of stuff. He did. He racked it up pretty quickly, actually.
Well, it's safe now. Back in the 60s and 70s, most states had 5 to 25 for mere possession.
Mm.
I got busted in Pittsburgh, and I ended up with 2 years of probation. And as the judge said, you're a Vietnam veteran, so I'm going to give you 2 years on probation. And I got busted in Florida. I ended up beating that on illegal search. But I think I was facing 5 years in prison in Florida. So it was not a toy to play with back then, because there were people in the South that were serving 25 years for mere possession. Nowadays, most marijuana possession ends up in probation. and usually relatively short term. So I will say it's a lot safer to go to demonstrations now and to do such things. Back then in the 60s, too, there were many demonstrations. If you look, go back and look at some of the file footage on that, there were there was one in Santa Cruz, not the one I got arrested at, but a nurse was going home from the hospital, and she happened to get caught up in the people running from the police, and she was beaten bloody on the side of the road. Blood flowed in the streets in the 60s in the anti-war demonstrations. I have yet to see blood flow even close to what most of the demonstrations resulted in back then, in these OWS and any of these other demonstrations. They get tear gassed and they get upset. The moratorium in Washington in 1969, I was up on the mall then, and an intersection below us, the cops came in from three sides, pushing people from these streets into the intersection, and then started throwing tear gas on the road that came up to the mall to keep them from going to the mall, and then kept pressing on them, beating them. And there was blood flowing, and people were breathing tear gas, high concentrations of it, for 5 or 10 minutes. And we went down to a wall and tried to pull people up that tried to get out through a parking lot. There was no escape. I mean, they were brutal back then compared to now. They didn't have the big shields. They didn't have the face masks. They weren't equipped like they are now. But the commitment back then had consequences much more severe, whether it be possession of marijuana, you know, prison time, right, or being beat to a pulp. And people were being beat to a pulp. Many pictures of people with blood just almost gushing out of their head. And they beat them on the head back then, too. Now they beat them on the side, so it doesn't show so much.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so when you get to civil disobedience, it's become an art form now as opposed to a commitment that was required back then. And yeah. So, you know, like I've said many times, until people start carrying pitchforks, and at least there's a threat.
Yeah.
I mean, carrying signs, it's almost a joke. It's an inconvenience.
It is a joke. And that's why I don't feel any, you know, I don't feel hesitant in saying sign waving cowards, because that's what it is.
Yes, but it does sell newspapers and we get it in defense fund contributions.
Right.
So it's a
right.
Good deal, I guess.
Yeah. Right. And so, sorry, before I forget, so in that one of those last scenes of that documentary, so he was looking at like all these consecutive sentences, but in order to avoid that, if he took a plea agreement, then I think he was going to get like 2 months or 3 months. Comparatively, it was way shorter. And he would get, I think, like 2 or 3 years probation or something to that effect. And obviously, he took the plea agreement. And then they show him walking into the jail, and then they show another scene where he's actually in the jail on a teleconferencing video phone or whatever. And then later they show the big welcome, you know, all the other Free Staters outside the jail when he walks out, everyone's hugging him. And then apparently he actually leaves New Hampshire because there were some complications or something to that effect. But the point is that, yeah, he took a plea agreement, which of course kind of raises other questions, obviously.
He dropped his principles on the Free State Project too, didn't he, by leaving New Hampshire?
Well, there were other complications. I don't exactly remember, but what really stuck in my mind was the plea agreement thing, because obviously when you're dancing the tango two-step with the secret police, the last thing you want anyone involved on your side is some sort of a plea agreement on their end. And you know, that's, I don't know, I partially feel sorry for the guy, but on the other hand, I don't think he really was careful about what activities he was going to engage in. And at the end of the day, it kind of, you know, kind of has to beg the question, what did he actually accomplish? And I can't find anything.
Getting back to the original subject, the sand has gotten a lot softer in the last 20, 30 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was kind of alluding to. Yeah.
So the commitment to civil disobedience, or the commitment to the patriot cause, the line on the sand has become
mushy. Well, I mean, yeah.
Mushy, soupy, something. Yeah, I don't know what the right.
Well, I mean, like for example, if I say resist tyrants, I'm thinking more, you know, either preparatory stuff for guerrilla warfare or an offshoot of that, or actual guerrilla warfare. So the actual either, you know, warfare itself or a support function of some kind. When I've heard other people talk about resisting tyranny, what they really mean, and in their actions, because actions speak louder than words, like my mom said, taught me when I was young, is like what? Filing paperwork, waving signs, and yakking people's ear off? You know, on a public street corner.
Well, you're forgetting one, the bravado. Don't forget the bravado.
And the bravado, thank you, yes. I don't know, Gary. I just, at the end of the day, I just, again, it's my reaction to Sandy Hook as the most recent example I can think of. I just don't get hyped up about these things like I know some of the other guys in the alternative media do. And I've told them, please don't get hyped up. It's not worth the energy. Instead, I'd suggest instead, here are some other areas you can focus in. But most of them don't listen to me. They don't take my advice. And they like getting hyped up, you know, that sensationalistic, ooh, something in the air is stirring, when it's not something of substance that's stirring.
Let's look at a good research project, shall we?
Yeah, sure.
Now we're going to focus the research strictly on what's available on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to take some media rock stars, Patriot rock stars, I think. Is that the term you use, Patriot rock stars?
It was actually Randy who coined the term, but yeah, Patriot rock stars, yes.
Okay.
The divas.
Take some Patriot rock stars and go back and search the internet. I mean, this is an extensive job. I mean, some of these guys probably have many thousands of pages. But go back and date what their bravado claims. And show the timeline, the history of their bravado claims, and maybe put a YouTube together on it. And show that this line, how many times this line has slid.
Oh, wow, that's an excellent project idea. In fact, for one particular project...
Qualify it, make sure that you identify in your final results that you have searched only the internet. But show how many pages you've researched as well. I mean, be honest about your research.
Wow, that is an excellent idea. I might need to pass that along to somebody.
Yeah, you don't have time now with all that we've got going on, but that would prove that somebody was a real researcher.
In fact,
you have to go back to where that person said it. You can't go to where somebody said he said it. You have to go back to where he said it.
Right, the original source material. In fact,
date, exactly what he said, the context, everything.
In fact, since you mentioned that wonderful project idea, if somebody wanted to, God, let me think for a minute. It was late 1999. So it was the Y2K scare. And I remember that when I was a kid. I remember he was making claims, and there are old broadcasts of this. They might be up on YouTube. I think that might be the only place available left because I think they were removed from his original archives or something. But he was claiming it was something... I'm kind of going off my memory here. Something about Russians invading when the computers get shut off or something. It was something really strange.
Yeah, anything where he's giving a timeline on it qualifies as
propaganda. I think he did, actually.
Well, I think you can go back to Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh as well. Rush Limbaugh, you can go back, 30 years? I guess when did he start back in the 80s, right?
Yeah,
all the way back, and he has predicted things. Now, you know, I think Rush is a tool of the Republican Party, but he's still got a substantial following in the Patriot community. Mm-hmm. And Glenn Beck,
he tells them what they want to hear. I mean,
that's exactly it. And if he wants, if he's predicting that this is going to happen by then, that becomes the bravado.
Well, okay. Well,
not quite the same as the I'm going to give them one bullet at a time, but it's hypocrisy.
Okay. Well, here's probably the penultimate question then.
And then when you do it, you have to also, in all fairness to the subject of the research, is if he came out and said by Christmas this is going to happen, and he comes out after Christmas and says I was wrong, that negates that one. You can include it, but show his integrity in admitting he was wrong.
Okay, well, I'll definitely pass that on to someone, obviously. But here's probably the penultimate question that's been bugging me forever. Is the line in the sand a real thing? And if so, where what rough gauge should be used to actually draw it? Or is it just an unanswerable question?
Well, I would suggest Long Beach, either New York or California, because Long Beach, to draw the line in the sand in this in the context that it's used by most people now. Now, I wrote an article back in the 90s called The Line is Drawn, and it had to do with the exclusionary rule, H.R. 666. And I was talking about if this passed, there should be a line in the sand, because they were going to say that the I don't know if it's passed or not. I don't recall. But basically, the exclusionary rule, they were going to say that if the evidence was obtained illegally, as long as they could come up with some rationalization for the illegal obtaining of evidence, that they could use it in court. Now, that destroys the justice system. The justice process in this country has been destroyed any number of ways. But the talk back then, and especially with this 666 being the House resolution number, everybody thought this should be it because of the 666, the evil. But I have to say, I fell into that. I said, if this passes, that should be the line. That should be where we draw the line. If this passes, we should act. I believed we should act. Now, people have accused me of, well, you haven't acted. Well, no, I'm not dumb enough to take it on alone, but I'm trying to move people along that not-so-thin line as rapidly as I can. But, people accuse me, oh, you're not in the militia. You can't talk about militia. Oh, shit, I can't talk about the Constitution because I'm not in the militia. Okay, but, you know, at 66 years old, I'm probably a little too old to go humping out in the woods. Paintball.
Yeah, and I can definitely, because even yes. For me, it's it can be challenging. So, yeah, I can only imagine.
But then I take another posture, too. I mean, after Waco, people liked my writing so much, they encouraged me to take up writing. So did it cost me anything? Well, I gave up a business of 16 years. I was making $85,000 a year or more, clearer, and I walked away from that. So, you know, I've made a commitment to what I do. My commitment, though, if I can write, then I should be in Philadelphia, not at Bunker Hill.
Right.
And that's where people had asked me to go, to Philadelphia, not to Bunker Hill. And I will remain in Philadelphia trying to use the pen instead of the sword as much as I possibly can. That seems to suit my abilities far better than my military training. I went through basic training, and then I learned how to keep airplanes in the air, and I learned how to look at aerial photographs. But those that are trained in infantry or artillery or in any of the combat arts, they have no excuse unless they are good writers. And good writers, let's get back to researchers and investigative reporters. If they're good writers, perhaps they should consider that the pen can be more powerful than the sword. But if their bravado is there and they've drawn that line in the sand, damn it, you drew the line.
Well, then would I be incorrect in saying then that the line in the sand is a myth?
In the context that I've seen it for the last 20 years, I would say yes, it is nearly mythical. I think there are some people, some friends of mine, George Sibley and Linda Lyon, they were executed by the state of Alabama because they drew a line in the sand. They killed a cop and they died. Gordon Call, he drew a line in the sand, he died. The Davidians drew a line in the sand.
Yeah, we all know what happened to them, yeah.
Right. But they made the commitment. They got the children, or many of the children out. The list I read was the ones that were inside at the time. I think there's other cases where people have made a commitment, and they've stood by it. But the percentage is so small, it's unbelievable. I know I was faced with the cops breaking down, kicking in my office door, coming in with their 9mm pointed at my head, and I had a 9mm 380 about 6 inches from my hand on my desk, and a loaded AK-47 about a foot and a half to the left of me. But discretion can be the better part of valor. I did not defend myself, and I knew I was getting arrested for failure to appear, and I didn't think that was a cause worth dying for. But I don't believe that I've made any commitments anywhere along the line where I said I would do something, drawn a line in the sand, when they cross this, I'm going to pick up my rifle.
Yeah.
But those that say that, that are foolish enough to say it and not mean it, you know, I don't really know what to call them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's the other problem, too, is that...
I'll refrain from describing them any further than that.
Right, right. And see, the other problem, too, is that even if, you know, that kind of classical understanding of what that concept is supposed to be, you see, the other problem I have with it is more for a military reason. If they actually did mean it, why would you declare it publicly before you go do your operation? Doesn't that, you know, give like a... Isn't warning the enemy that you're about to attack in an actual war? Isn't that kind of counterintuitive? I mean,
I don't know. I don't think that Gordon Call said I'm drawing a line in the sand. I don't think Randy Weaver did. But they, when the time came, they drew the line nonetheless, and it was clear to most people that the line had been drawn. Yeah, to say it. It is kind of foolish because you're tempting somebody to come back and prove you wrong. So actually, it does have a kind of a negative effect, I guess, in the long run, because who has stood up? Who has declared that they've drawn the line and stood up to it? They have. Many have acted. And I will say that George and Linda probably, at least in private conversation, said, we're only going to go so far. You know, there's... so I have personal knowledge of them not quite drawing a line, but frustrated and willing to resort to violence in defense of their rights.
So maybe instead of...
They
so,
not make public proclamation on the internet that I've drawn a line.
Right, 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 because that's grandiose standing, and or yeah, they're trying to seem grandiose and what have you. So would it be a better instead... to just make a personal, for every individual to make a decision in their heart about what they are willing to do and not do ahead of time, and then that would be the proverbial line in the sand, I guess? Maybe that's not the best
way
of phrasing
it. Well, it's really hard to do on an individual basis unless your activity itself is demonstrative of something that might create a scenario whereby that line would be drawn.
Hmm.
But then you'd be a fool to go public with it.
Let's assume that there's no public pronouncements then. You just make a decision in the quiet of your heart, so to speak. Or is the line in the sand still mythical?
I have made one in my heart, and I damn sure ain't going to express it in public or to anybody, even in private, to you.
Right, right, right. Okay.
To back down if it ever occurs. You know, the funny thing, back to those cops breaking in my office.
Sure.
When something occurs, you have a split second to make a decision. And it's hard to judge what decision you would make if you've never found yourself in that position.
Okay.
Well, but when you have militias that claim to have a common pact to defend each other, and then you flee from that. And this goes back to what was called the Republic of Texas, Richard McLaren. Everybody was back Richard McLaren, and I think I wrote an article on it. I know I wrote an article on it. I don't know if it's on the internet, but when they were going after Richard McLaren, everybody made excuses. Oh, it's too far. We can't get there. But the excuse was.
Oh, dear God, no. And,
these were the militias back in the mid-90s that were doing those. We're going to do that radio show on security team. Now, security team's a little different. Ours was self-defense in a communal effort, a very small group of people. And I will say that these people, and the only ones that I can name on that seven on the security team, were George and Linda and myself. The other people, even though that security team doesn't exist, I will never publicly mention their names. So we had made a commitment. Now let's see how that worked. When I came back from Texas, we did something deceptive to get the FBI to think. I didn't know if there was a concern or not, but the people working with me, we came up with this plan to make it look like I was going to Colorado. And instead, I went back to Orlando. And when I got to Orlando, there were three people armed right outside of the security gate. They couldn't go inside the security back then with a gun.
Of course.
But they were, you could go, if you weren't flying, you could go within, but you had to go through the metal detector. So they were waiting outside, and when I walked out of that security, I saw all three of them spread all over in very good positions, that if something happened to me after I left the security area at Orlando International Airport, they would have been there to defend me. That night, they got me a whole motel room in their name, and they spent the night there. Two of them spent the night with me, armed, one of them staying awake all night. We didn't know what the repercussions would be after what I did in Waco in trashing the government. So it worked. Now, later on, George and Linda got arrested. They were concerned they had been using my fax machine at the office. It cost me $800. It was a real nice one back then. And they had faxed out, and there's a, they believe there was a chip in that fax machine that recorded all the numbers that anything they faxed ever went to, and perhaps even kept an image of what they faxed. Mm-hmm. So they were in jail in Opelika, Alabama, and I was up on the Golden Hill Pisgesic Reservation in Connecticut. But when I talked to Linda, she wanted that chip destroyed. So I called one of the security team members in Florida, told him where he could get, how he could get a key to get in my office, and his instructions were, and this is in the afternoon, his instructions were take that fax machine out in the swamp with an axe and tear it into as small pieces as possible. Look for any electronic chips, take them far away and throw them in a river or a stream or something.
Right.
He called me back about 11 or 12 that evening and said, the deed is done. Now, this is commitment. This is a security team, and these are people standing by what they said they'd do. I woke him up in the middle of the night. Again, when Peter Chernoff and his son Alex and Linda Issel had fled California, there was a $500,000 bond on Peter Chernoff. It was a $500,000 bond on him. He was fleeing from what they called child stealing. I don't remember the exact charge now. He came to my office, but I was kind of concerned because my secretary had reported white cars going back and forth, and I didn't want to take any chances, so I contacted one of the security team members. Late that night, we moved Peter and Alex and Linda down to his house. He had no qualms in standing behind, hiding a fugitive from justice, which can have federal consequences, had no qualms hiding that person. So these people on the security team had made a commitment. And every time it was tested, it was...
Well, they were serious.
Without question.
Yeah, so it sounds like they were actually serious. So they,
Lines of the sand. Just when an incident came up, their response was total commitment, whatever I have to do.
Yeah, and nothing less than that is going to count, I would assume. Okay. So obviously public pronouncements of lines is well, I'm going to say it is retarded. So I guess the only thing left is if it's already has this mythical quality to it.
This bravado, it's a bully bragging, I can kick your ass, give me your lunch money.
Right. It's not a serious, adult thing of commitment, basically.
It's just immature.
Okay, well then, okay, I guess the only other aspect that's a little bit unclear in my mind then is that, is it even worth the effort to, again, in like the private, in your own, the private depths of your heart, I guess, to kind of war game or otherwise try and make a decision ahead of time as to how you will act or all that, or is doing that ahead of time, and obviously you don't talk about it, obviously, but is doing that ahead of time what you're willing to do and not do, or at least war game it, is that even worth it, or do you just act whenever something comes up?
Well, if it's individual, I mean,
yeah,
I don't
that's what
know
I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
I would react. I know how I think I would react, but I know that I've been there. I had those guns. But I how do you define the circumstances that give you enough time, accessibility and all that to define it? You don't. And so until you get there, you can't. So can you really draw a line? Okay, let's draw a line. Let's see how many different scenarios can occur that I want to draw a line on.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay, let me
get back with you next month when I've finished at least half the list. Can we do that? You know, I'll tell you what it's worth when somebody draws a line. It's worth this, a chuckle, because every time I see it, I kind of chuckle to myself because this is bullshit.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah, and actually, that kind of interesting you mentioned that, because I think I remember talking to you a while back, and I think I mentioned something about how I was upset or thinking that, well, I was just postulating this before, but that, you know, if a Chinese styled one child policy was ever enforced here in these United States, then maybe, you know, the guys should, you know, take up arms and secure our liberties that way. And I think what you mentioned to me before, I think, kind of plays in hand. Like, that's not necessarily, you know, why use that as a benchmark?
Well, that's a safe one.
Yeah, yeah.
It can happen in your lifetime, man. You can probably honestly say that. Whether you would do anything if that occurred or not, you will probably never find out. So you're a lot safer than saying that when they go after a militia, I'm going to go. That's the line.
So even something like that, at the end of the day,
it's still worth a chuckle, though.
Okay, so at the end of the day, all things considered, looking at this backwards, forwards, inside out, et cetera, from as many angles as possible, the whole line in the sand concept is not just mythical; it's intellectually dishonest.
Intellectually dishonest and publicly dishonest, you know. I mean, it's both. It's a fraud.
Okay. Well, I then go. I guess then, kind of coming back full circle to the Alamo. Then, I mean, then are people, especially in the Patriot community, extrapolating and have been extrapolating too much from what Colonel
Let's
Travis
look,
did?
Let's look back at the Alamo. There was a pretty done deal there.
Yeah.
You either stay or you go. If you stay, how many soldiers does Santana have?
I don't remember the precise numbers,
but
it was thousands. It was a lot 6,000, of people.
Something
it,
like that.
Yeah, it was a real army. Yeah,
That's a done deal. You stay, you're going to die.
Yeah. That's why
it's not ambiguous, like if a militia is attacked, then we're going to defend them, unless the government says they're bad guys. So, you know, you can have a situation where that commitment could be made. Let's just say, for example, a militia is on an FTX and they got 20, 30 guys there, and then the government surrounds them and say, you're under arrest. Well, at that point, we can draw a definitive line in the sand. Who's going to go out with their hands? In fact, it happened at Waco. Who's going to go out with their hands up?
Yeah.
And who's not? Who's going to stand here because of our beliefs? So you can run into something where you can draw the line in the sand nowadays if you're unfortunate enough to be in the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place at the right time, whether you want to be true to what you say or you want to try and avoid anything that would require a real commitment, a life commitment to something.
That sounds like an exception to the rule, though, because most of the time people are...
But it would be. See, we're back to the Alamo, though, where it's specific. Okay, are you going to come out with your hands up, or are you going to fight and die?
Yeah, and unfortunately, what we're dealing with in the attempt to try to secure our liberties is that most people in the Patriot community, and you know, myself included and whatnot, are not... Our normal day in and day out activities are not a last stand type situation.
No, they're not. And so it's easy to say because they're not in a position to have that commitment proven.
So they can express
it freely. They can look really brave by doing it.
Quote unquote brave. So what you're saying is that's how the self-deception works then. Okay. So basically the takeaway, the lesson to be learned here, if I'm thinking this right, is that it's a myth. The line, the concept, sand as it is commonly understood in political dissident circles, and especially the Patriot community, is it's a myth, it's fraudulent, and it's intellectually dishonest.
Well, let's look at the current gun control. Let's look at it now. Gun control. If they pass this law, that's the line in the sand.
Yeah,
well,
I'm not going to turn my guns
minute.
In. I'm not going to turn my guns in. That's the claim.
I'll tell you quite frankly... if I had guns, I wouldn't turn them in. I'll tell you quite frankly that those laws don't apply to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they don't. Now, the problem is if, and this is, I think you've heard me say this before, my biggest problem is if I have a gun and a cop stops me and he sees the gun and he thinks I don't have a right to have that gun and I know that I do, what are the consequences? Now, at that point, I have to draw that line. In my mind, at least, I'm not going to have time to advertise it on the internet, but I will have to draw that line if that occurs. It will depend a lot on the circumstances.
So you have to do it at the time it happens. You can't war game right? it way ahead of time. Okay.
George fired the first shot at the cop. The cop had reached for his gun. George drew his gun. The cop ran back with his hand still on the gun in his holster, ran back and hid behind his car door. George started shooting at him. The cop then drew his gun and started shooting at George. Linda was on the payphone nearby. She heard the shooting, looked out, saw what was happening, so she dropped the phone, came around behind the cop, and shot him from in the back. They called it cowardly.
Yeah.
Well, shit, when somebody's trying to kill your husband, is it cowardly to keep yourself out of that line of fire and sneak up behind? Military tactic, man. Flank them.
Yeah, well, I mean, gee,
police do it all the time. We've got you surrounded. Come out with your hands up. They've got snipers that put a bullet through your head. And it's cowardly for her to defend her husband's life?
Yeah, obviously. Obviously, that's
George spin. Didn't have a door to hide behind. Not that doors do much good. That's the difference between concealment and cover.
Oh, God, yeah.
Cover stops bullets. Concealment stops visual observation. That door, unless they put Kevlar and cop doors, that door is concealment. It's not cover.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Gary, I think you know, talking with you about this has really kind of settled a lot of the qualms in my mind. And I think I'll also write an article about this, but I actually feel a lot better talking about this now, because I feel now that I can actually have some sense of closure when it comes to this particular concept. Because to me, initially, it seemed like there were some good aspects to it, obviously, but it also seemed like there were some perverse aspects to it. And now that you've helped me clarify what's really been going on and helped me think this through, I think I know what I need to do on this one. And I think what I'm going to do is, besides writing an article about it, I think I'm going to pretty much close the book on it, because it's a distraction, really.
Yeah, you've made understatements before.
Well, okay.
Distraction is a very polite way of I mean, like I say, it's a chuckle when I see it.
Yes. Okay. Well,
it's not a distraction, not at all. I mean, what I've done is learned something about the person that has bravado, and I've got to question whether he really means what he says.
Well, what I meant by distraction was simply just believing in the concept that it is commonly understood in the alternative media. But yes, I have learned something very much, and I do think that's valuable. So thank you for that. I really do appreciate it.
Well, you just slid along that line a little bit more towards the right.
Hey, I got to make some progress, right? All right. Hey, thanks, Gary. Appreciate it.
Okay. I'll talk to you later.
All right, bye.